Was Increments'd by alto saxophonist Tim Byrne and pianist Matt Mitchell. It comes from the album Spiders, which is a digital-only release available now on Bandcamp. Tim Byrne is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the Osiris Network. If you enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content, so become a subscriber if you can. This is episode 60 of the show, which is a pretty exciting milestone for me, but before we get into it, I want to talk to you about Harry's Razors. If you're a regular listener, you know I've been talking about them for a while now, and I'm absolutely hooked at this point. It's the best shave I've ever had, so if you're looking to upgrade your personal appearance, or you're looking for the right holiday gift for a dude of your acquaintance, you should absolutely go with Harry's. For a limited time, listeners of my show can get $5 off a holiday shave set by heading to harrys.com/burning. I'm telling you, it's a quality product. Harry's uses German-engineered steel blades that last, and an award-winning razor with a heavy-duty weighted handle that sits comfortably in your hand. They're backed by a 100% quality guarantee, so if you or the person you're buying them for don't love it, you get a full refund. Blade refills are as low as $2 each, so you save money in the long run over buying disposable razors at CVS or wherever. And the Harry's holiday shave sets that they're selling come in a pre-packaged holiday-themed gift box, and they even offer engraving for the razor handle, and 1% of each sale is donated to charity. As I said, new customers can get $5 off plus free shipping on any holiday shave set when you go to harrys.com/burning. The set comes with a weighted handle, 3 razor cartridges, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover, all packaged in a handsome holiday gift box. To claim your $5 off plus free shipping, go to harrys.com/burning this holiday season. Okay, Tim Byrne. I first heard him on a John Zorn album, Spy vs. Spy, from 1989, where the two of them, plus Mark Dresser on bass and Joey Barron and Michael Vacher on drums, play 17 Ornette Coleman tunes in 40 minutes. It's one of the most intense records you'll ever hear in your life. They play almost all the tunes at like hardcore punk speed, and the two drummers are delivering blast beats like they're auditioning for Napalm Death or something. Some people love it and some people fucking hate it. But I am definitely in the former category. And while Burns' own music doesn't always have that same punk rock aggression, it's definitely intense and can get very loud at times. He's originally from upstate New York, but he's been based in Brooklyn for basically his entire professional career, which started in the 1970s when he was studying with Julius Hemphill. Hemphill is Burns' single biggest influence, as you'll hear in this interview. Burn is extremely independent. He started two different labels to put out his own music. First, Empire, which he used to make five albums in the late 70s, and then later Screwgun, which continues to this day. He was signed to Columbia for a couple of years, though, and had made a bunch of records for ECM with his current primary band, Snake Oil. And they've been together for about a decade and are now releasing stuff on Intact out of Switzerland. Burns bands tend to have really great names. He's led Hard Cell, C-E-L-L, Chaos Totale, Science Friction, Blood Count, and Big Satan, among others. He's also currently a member of Broken Shadows, a quartet with Chris Speed on tenor sax, Reed Anderson on bass, and Dave King on drums. They play the music of Ornette Coleman, Julius Hemphill, Dewey Redman, and Charlie Hayden. And they have a couple of live albums you can get on Bandcamp, and a studio LP that's only available as part of a ridiculously expensive subscription box set from the Nouvelle, N-E-W-V-E-L-L-E, label. This interview was recorded last week, on Thursday, November 5th, which is why I mention obsessively refreshing Twitter at the beginning, because we were both kind of waiting for election results along with everyone else. We talk about a lot of subjects. Burn has been a really influential composer, particularly among 21st century jazz players from Brooklyn, so we discuss that. But we also talk about Hemphill a lot. We talk about his various bands and his creative relationships with Matt Mitchell and David Torn, about his approach to composing, and about the depth of his catalog, and much more. I had a really good time talking to him, and I hope you'll enjoy listening to our conversation. I'm going to play one more piece of music before I roll the interview. This is More Notes, spelled M-O-O-R-N-O-A-T-S, from The Deceptive Four, a new double live CD by Snake Oil, which features Matt Mitchell on piano, Oscar Noriega on clarinet, and Chez Smith on drums. And the full piece is almost 17 minutes long, but this is like the first 2.5 minutes of it. So listen to that, and afterwards you'll hear my conversation with Tim Burn. Thank you.
Hello?
Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hey.
Hey, Phil Freeman, how are you?
Good. As good as one can be right at the moment.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Well, it's, I guess an interview is better than, refreshing Twitter every 5 seconds, looking for
Yeah, no
results.
shit.
So.
I hear you. How are you doing?
Doing all right, I'm
Yeah.
yeah. So yeah, I've got a fair amount of questions, about
Okay.
a bunch of different things. So I guess I'll just kind of dive right in.
Great.
From what I know, you studied a little bit with Braxton early on, and then he kind of passed you on to Julius Hemphill, who was sort of your biggest influence. So do you see your own work as coming out of like the AACM and Black Artists Group tradition? Like, is there a tradition there to come out of, as in your mind? Like, what,
I mean, I would say, I mean, definitely Julius, the Dogon record, I'm sure was like a huge thing for me. I think I bought it when it came out, and there was a record store in Syracuse that had all that stuff, and I just got liked the cover, and I bought it, and listened to it probably every day, and for about a year. At that time, I wasn't a musician yet. I hadn't started playing, so I was just a rabid fan, and I was lucky where there was a good radio station in Syracuse, and there were people putting on good concerts at the college. So I don't know, probably in my teens I got into this kind of stuff in addition to everything else. I was into soul music. I was into pretty much whatever my brothers were into, and luckily they had good taste. So to make a long story short, I met Braxton in 72. I decided not to go to college for a year, and so I earned some money, and then me and my friend went to Europe. And I think his interest was going to Europe and just fucking around. I sort of had an ulterior motive. I was going to go to Paris because I knew all those guys were there, Braxton and the Black Artist Group, those guys, Bobo Shaw, Bakita Carroll. And so I kind of knew I was going to go right to Paris and see if I could figure out where those guys were and hear them play. And I walked into this place called the American Center, which I must have known was kind of a center for those guys. And I walked in, and there's Braxton practicing. And I met him, talked to him, had a really nice chat with him. And he must have, I think he gave me his address. And we ended up writing letters back and forth. He actually answered me. And then he told me he was coming back to New York. This is now 74. And this is when he did that record Fall 74 and got signed with Arista. And coincidentally, my brother went out with this woman who was friends with Michael Kiscuna. So Kiscuna, at the time I got interested in playing saxophone, and I was kind of fucking around. This must have been 73. Somebody sold me a saxophone for $100, and I was just noodling around. And then when I moved to New York, I bought a Selmer. He helped me get that Kiscuna. And then I can't remember if this is before or after Braxton, but I had asked Braxton about giving me lessons, and he said it was cool. He was moving into Frederick Shepsky's apartment, which was up in the Bronx. And so right around that time, Kiscuna invited me to a recording session, and it was a Lester Bowie session called, the record is called Fast Last. And Julius was on it, and Julius had composed some music for it. But I didn't know this. All I knew was it was a Lester Bowie recording. And when I went there, it was an overdub session, so Lester wasn't there. But there was a tuba player. I believe it was Bob Stewart or Joe Daly, one of those guys. And they were overdubbing on one of the tunes. And there was a big tall guy out there sort of conducting. And I didn't know who it was. And I was too scared to ask. So I just kind of sat there and listened and watched. And my educated guess was that it was Oliver Nelson. I have no idea why I thought that.
Yeah.
you know, I saw some guy conducting, and I said, oh, yeah, Oliver Nelson, he's a composer. It's probably him, you know. So, ironically, it was Julius, but I didn't know it at the time. So I didn't meet him, and I didn't know he lived in New York. You know, I thought he lived in, I thought he was in California or St. Louis. Or so anyway, make a really long story short, a couple of days later, I went to Studio Rigby to hear a concert, and that was Sam Rivers' place. And most of the flyers for the Sam Rivers stuff, almost 50% of the time, the group you thought you were going to see didn't, it wasn't them, and it was a completely different group. You know, it was pretty loose. And so I went there, and I saw this amazing group. It was, and that tall guy was playing alto, and I'm like, wow, who the fuck is this guy? He's insane. And I still didn't know it was Julius because he wasn't on the flyer. Turns out it was Lester, Julius. You know, I recognized Lester because I'd seen the art ensemble. And it was Lester, Julius, Bobo Shaw, Abdul Wadud, and this guitar player who played with Miles called Dominique Gaumont or something.
Sure, sure.
So it was him. And then Blew It. And so I still didn't know it was Julius, and I didn't say anything. You know, I just kind of, you know, whatever, walked out of there. And then I had finally hooked up with Braxton. So when I took my lessons with Braxton, I took three lessons. And then he said, look, I'm getting really busy because of this Arista stuff. And, you know, I'm going to have to stop, but I'll give you Hemphill's number. Because he knew I was into Julius. And I almost dropped dead. I was like, what? You know, Hemphill? And he goes, yeah, he lives in Brooklyn. And so, you know, I got up the nerve. I called him. He was shocked. I think he was pretty surprised anyone even knew who he was. So I called him, and we hooked up a lesson. And then I went out to Brooklyn, where I'd never been before. This is now 74. And found him and found the place and walked in. And of course, he forgot. He had forgotten that we were doing this. It was like 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And then it just took off from there. And then I, you know, spent a great deal of time with him, several years, really. And it wasn't really lessons at that point. It was just friendship and talking about stuff all the time, you know, music. And I helped him do concerts and helped him with his label and kind of learned the ropes as I was learning how to play.
Mm.
So what? To answer your question about the bag thing,
yeah,
and the AACM, I would say at the beginning, it was the biggest influence, because I think I was way into, you know, art ensemble, all those guys. I was just really, you know, the bag guys, you know, it was mostly Julius. I knew about Oliver, you know, that album Heavy Spirits, but I didn't identify them the way I did with the AACM, because the bag thing was, it was kind of lesser known that there was this group. I mean, I knew it from Julius, but they just didn't have the same presence in the public, you know, record-wise and otherwise, you know, in terms of the press. It was really more about the AACM, and you know, there was Leo Smith, there was Leroy Jenkins, there was Threadgill, you know, there were just more guys, Cal Perugia, and I knew about all that stuff. And I think the music was less intimidating than, say, oh, I'm going to learn bebop, you know, I'm a beginner. And so there was an entryway that perhaps wasn't possible as a beginner, you know, into the bebop thing. You know, there weren't really rules that you knew about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I could go play free with somebody and kind of feel like I'm in the ballpark, even though I wasn't, you know.
Something that occurred to me when I heard that you started playing so late in life, comparatively speaking, was that maybe you were able to avoid the trap of virtuosity that a lot of, like, young saxophone players fall into, you know?
Well, I would have loved to have fallen into that trap, but I just didn't know any better. I mean, you know, I would have loved to be, you know what I'm saying? I wasn't anti-technique, I wasn't anti-jazz. I was just pro, I'm going to work my ass off, and this is what appeals to me. In addition, you know, I was going to see Sonny Rollins, I was going to see McCoy Tyner, Joe Henderson, you know, all this stuff was accessible,
mm-hmm.
you know, live. And Herbie Hancock, Mondesi, Weather Report, I saw them in 72 or 3. right when they started. You know, so I'd seen all these guys, and I kind of lumped it all together. I didn't really, because I wasn't a musician, I didn't really have to segregate these styles. You know, nothing, to me, music wasn't a style. It was just something to listen to. And so, you know, I was listening to James Brown, I was listening to Sonny Rollins, and I was listening to Cecil Taylor. And I saw all of them live, you know. And so until I started playing, I didn't even think about it as, you know, the fact that there's styles, or you're a sideman, or you're a leader, or you're a composer. It was just like magic. And that was the first thing Julius talked to me about. You know, he said, first thing out of his mouth was, yeah, I've been thinking a lot about magic. And then he explained what that meant to him in regard to music. And to me, it was magic. You know, you go hear music and you'd get some, you know, something spiritual, like, which I didn't call it that at the time, but that's basically what it is. You know, it feeds your soul and you feel better, you know, and then it sort of inspires you to want to do something, you know, be creative or contribute something to the world besides just going to work, you know. And so I think I knew that intuitively, but I didn't really understand the nuts and bolts, you know. And because I started really studying with Julius, he never said I couldn't do this or I couldn't do that. You know, I started writing music right away. You know, it was very barbaric, but I was doing it. And he never said, oh, you can't do that, you're a beginner. You know, we just did everything at the same time. You know, we were talking about technique, and that was more like, you know, he would just say, yeah, I mean, scales, exercises, you can figure that out. And then he said, you should make up your own too, you know, but composing was just making something up, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I had to figure out what that meant. And then what, you know, as you do it more, there are more roadblocks because you learn more, you know? So then all of a sudden you're like, oh fuck, you know, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do that. When I started, I didn't know what I didn't know, so I just kind of did it. And yeah. I was quite, you know, I was quite prolific and kind of in a really naive and insecure way. I had this inner confidence, you know. I knew that I knew how to make shit up. And because he reduced it, in a way, I think it was because he took the real big word, you know, he didn't say composer, he just said make shit up, you know. And you talk about blue collar composing versus white collar instead of classical. And, you know, so it kind of demystified it for a while until I learned more and then started playing with musicians. And I realized there's all kinds of other things, you know, involved. But by then it was too late. I was in, you know.
So
it's a long story, you know, but.
Yeah. Years ago, I spoke to Bill Dixon. And one of the things that he told me that fascinated me was he said with his student ensembles up at Bennington, he said if he had somebody that could only play one note on their instrument, he could find a use for them in his ensemble.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, you can make that one noise, fine. We're going to work that one noise into the composition, and when I point at you, you make your noise, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's because his music, I gather, was more about ideas than what you can prove, you know, proving something. And so that's what I've always said. You know, I hear people and, you know, my peers and people around New York and everywhere else, and I hear something really, you know, incredibly technical and, you know, just impressive, and I get really intimidated. And then I try to remind myself that the only thing that really matters is the music, and is it interesting to listen to, is it emotionally, you know, whatever it is you like in music, does it do that, you know? And it's obviously subjective, but the problem, you know, when you start learning more and you start playing with people, then you become part of that, then you start getting really insecure about what you don't know, you know. And I have a lot of friends. You know, it really helps to talk to your friends about this stuff who play music, because everybody's going through the same thing. You know, I'm friends with, I mean, I talked to Tony Malaby about saxophone stuff, and I always feel better afterwards. You know, or I talk to Bramper Marcellus a lot, and I'll give him all my shit, and he just goes, shut the fuck up. you know, that's bullshit. You know what I mean? He'll kind of, you know, it, after a while, it's like the self-deprecation is, it gets old. Mm-hmm. And it's good to have friends who just say, well, do you really believe this, or are you just saying it, you know? And then if you do believe, you know, if it's true, you're deficient at something, then you fucking do something about it, you know? And that's why I like Bramford. He'll just say, okay, man, long tones. Just play long tones, quiet. That's what I've been doing. Or, you know, and then one time he just sent me these etude books because I was bitching about something. And he said, and then 3 days later, I get these etude books. And it's sort of like, oh, yeah, I used to do this. And it really would get me out of a rut, you know, just sit around and reading classical etudes, mm-hmm. you know, and you just have to be, you know, when you talk to people who are basically established, who are still taking lessons, you know, which is most of my friends are still studying, then it's inspiring, you know, and then you feel, you know, then I get inspired to do shit. That's why I like New York, you know, everybody's, it's not this weird competitive place. It's on the contrary, I think it's a super supportive environment. And so I would never want to leave here, you know, because I'm always finding people, you know, and it's not just sympathy. It's like, okay, motherfucker, do this. If you're not good at this, then do it, you know, mm-hmm. do it more.
See,
and that's what you want to hear, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like there are a couple of people who've had a really big impact actually on jazz composition for a particular school of musicians in the 90s and the mm-hmm. 2000s. And you're one of them. Mm-hmm. And then Steve mm-hmm. Coleman is another, you know, like
yep.
you're both guys who I can hear ideas that you've been exploring forever in the music of some younger people. And so, I mean, what do you think are sort of the core principles that run through all of your music? Because what I hear is I hear a heavy emphasis on rhythm. I hear
right.
the really long sort of winding melodies. And mm-hmm. the other thing is that your pieces are often really long, like 30, 40 minutes. And I'm wondering why you think it's important to kind of let a piece run like that also.
Well, I'll start at the beginning. I mean, in terms of influences, you know, I love Threadgill, I love Braxton, all those guys. I got to say, though, the core influence really is Julius. You know, I mean, I practically wanted to be him back then. And luckily, I wasn't good enough to copy him well. But everything I do came out of parts of what he was doing. You know, the melodic approach, the rhythmic stuff, the rubato improvising, you know, which came out of the Art Ensemble and all those guys. That was one of the big things, you know, is this kind of what people will erroneously call classical influence. These kind of, dense or not dense, but kind of atonal, rubato improvised sections that I'm known for and Julius had going on, whether it was recorded or documented or not. You know, it might have come to me, but when you hear it, you just automatically, it's like, oh, I didn't have to be the one to figure it out. I just heard it and now I like it and I'm going to do it, you know? So then you put your own thing into it. And I think what I did to extend whatever I got from him and all of those guys was this episodic kind of way of composing. And then I took it to an extreme, you know, I like the momentum of not stopping, you know, I like not stopping and talking to the audience because it kind of wakes me out of my, you know, trance. It's not that I don't like the audience. I just don't like coming out of my trance, you know? So I get into a trance when we're playing and I want to stay there. And it's this place, you know, people call it, you know, not thinking or whatever it is, you're exactly lined up with the moment. You know, you're not thinking ahead and you're not thinking behind. And you're not really thinking, you know, but you're just in this focused state of mind. And I don't really want to come out of it. And then the other thing is, I don't really like, I mean, I do it now because I've done so much shit, I could barely remember what I've done. But, you know, the head out thing of head in, head out, I just find it more interesting to keep going forward, you know, like a book or a movie, you know, you don't, the ending isn't the same as the beginning, you know, it's just a thing. And so the way I write, sometimes I write backwards. Sometimes I write the end first, and then I move backwards, you know. But it keeps the improviser on their toes, and it's sort of, you know, if you have a band with five people, then I create five sections, you know, so that each improvised section is distinct and nobody's repeating what has already been covered. Mm-hmm. And I used to do it, you know, back in the day, like Sanctified Dreams and whatever, my early stuff, I would do it using musical transitions, you know, usually composed transitions that would be, that would lead you to the next section and kind of point it out very, very clearly. This is where we're going now. Now I do it. There was a point when I started Blood Count, I decided that I didn't want to do that. I wanted to create a band that took responsibility for that. You know, everybody was equal. Everybody took responsibility for the transitions, and everybody took responsibility for the direction. And without saying it, clearly you can't repeat something that already happened. So if, you know, let's say there was a trio with me and Formanek and Jim Black, and with high energy and we're going nuts and blah, 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 then if Chris comes in, it's just understood that we're not going to do that again. You know, and so you had to collectively come up with a whole different thing. And the written music was there to kind of say, hey, here's a bunch of ideas. Here's some stimulus. What does this do for you? You know, and hopefully it provokes you, or it confuses you enough that you don't remember what your licks are. It just takes you out of your comfort zone and promotes ideas versus style or I don't know, you know, I don't know. It just takes you out of your comfort zone would be the best way to say it. And so that's what I'm trying to do, you know, and you know, I like writing it. At this point, you know, Snake Oil and stuff I've been doing now, there's so much chemistry and so much musicality. I don't have to say shit, you know, I just have to bring in a written piece of music. We play it, and then I go, okay, ad lib here, and then anybody can start playing the written music whenever they want. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to always be Matt, doesn't have to be Oscar all the time. Chet, you know, I basically hate when drummers set it up, you know, so I always tell the drummer, never set it up. You know, I don't want the drummer to say, oh, what's the tempo of the last section, I'm going to set it up, because it just spoils the drama. And also I like the idea that the tempos can change, you know, and a lot of drummers are good at remembering what they think the tempo should be, and then once they get there you can't really move it. So I like, you know, that's why you'll hear on the Snake Oil stuff a lot, you'll hear me and Matt playing some intense written thing and Chess just going apeshit or not playing, you know, or playing vibes, because he has literally no instruction. And so it keeps us, the element of surprise is there for us as well, must be for the audience, because we don't even know what's going to happen, you know. Yeah. And I don't even remember what the question was, but I definitely took all these things and then extended it. And I think the point that most or a lot of, you know, obviously I'm aware that a lot of people have checked my stuff out, musicians and younger ones, you know, and played around with the general ideas of what I'm doing. Not that I'm doing anything original. And the thing they oftentimes miss is that we're improvising. I'm not laying it out. You know, when people ask me what my concept is, it's let the bulls run, you know, and create an atmosphere where everyone feels like they have an equal part, equal role, you know, and they're not subservient to me, that I'm not in charge of the ideas. I'm not steering them anywhere. That's why these bands last, because it's almost like you're in your own band, except you don't have to worry about booking the gigs, you know. So, yeah. I mean, these guys can do whatever the fuck they want. And I think we all realize when, you know, every once in a while, you know, you have a shitty gig, and I think we're usually on the same page, but I'll never, or I try not to say anything judgmental, you know. And the only time I'm really judgmental is when I have to decide on takes when we're recording. But even then, it's, you know, we almost never do second takes because the band is so focused, you know, and everybody's so zeroed in on what the big picture is. I don't have to say anything, you know, and that's usually what I have to say at the beginning is look at the big picture, you know, think about where we're going. Don't, you know, you don't have to solo, you don't have to carry the section. We're just playing at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it always takes a minute for them to believe me because most band leaders direct the shit, you know? And I think the young people I see, it sounds, they're afraid to let somebody else inject their idea. You know, they want to control it. They want to be the composer. They want to be the band leader. And they want everybody to know it, you know? And I'm like, I'm thrilled. You know, if I see a review and they don't mention my name of one of my records, then I feel like I've succeeded, you know? You know what I mean? In a way, I'm trying not to call attention to anything, you know, and that's probably why a lot of people don't even know I'm a composer for better or worse, you know, and I'm kind of happy that it comes off as a band, you know.
Yeah.
When that happens.
The whole Big Satan Hard Sell Science Friction axis of groups, which was, mm-hmm. you know, you, Mark Ducrey, Craig Taborn, and Tom Rainey in various mm-hmm. combinations, like, how did mm-hmm. those groups differ from each other in your mind? Like, what made a tune right for one ensemble and not the others or whatever?
Well, I mean, the first one, I'm pretty sure Hard Sell was the first thing, but we did that record, The Shell Game. I was kind of stalking Craig. He lived in my neighborhood, and I didn't know him, and I'd never heard him play, but I would see him around, you know, and I just said, wow, I like this guy. This guy just looks like he's nuts. You know, he'd be great to play with. And I was kind of, at the time, I wanted to do something electric, but not with a guitar. I wanted an instrument that could sort of get the power of the guitar and simulate bass and cover a lot of orchestral ground and not be a guitar. And so, I don't know how I knew this, but I think I knew that he had done some electronic stuff, you know, and as you know, you probably know he was involved with Carl Craig when he was quite young. That what's that stuff called? Not hip hop, but
the Detroit techno stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, techno stuff. So he played with Carl Craig. I think I knew that, and somehow I knew that he played, you know, what I had an idea. I had made up this fake image of Craig, and I could hear it, and that, even though I'd never heard him play a note. And I knew he played with, you know, James Carter, but I still didn't know what he did. And so I'd see him in the neighborhood, and I'd kind of talk to him, and he looked terrified. But I'd say, man, do you want to play? You know, me and Tom are getting together, and he knew who I was, and, you know, I found out later he had seen me play in Minneapolis when he was, like, 15. So I didn't know that Craig was been listening to shit since he was 12, you know. So I got him to come over, and we did a session with Tom. And I even got him to bring some pedals, bring his shit. And I had a little keyboard, and we did this thing, and it was exactly what I thought it was going to be, you know, to a certain extent. And I just went, wow, this is it. This is what I want to do next. And so, you know, I set up some gigs and I wrote a ton of music. And that's kind of when my composing transitioned to, you know, piano-centric writing. You know, it changed everything. And it was something I feared for life. You know, I was afraid of the piano. I just felt like I didn't know how to play with piano players and it would be really hard. It'd be sort of impenetrable, you know, sound-wise, and there'd just be notes flying, and everything would be you know, that would create too much context for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, and then I met Craig, and then, you know, we started doing this electronic stuff, and I started bringing in music, and then I was like, holy shit, this is exactly, you know, it turns out he's like the best bass player in the world, in addition to being, you know, an incredible keyboard player sound-wise, and an incredible, you know, piano player, and completely insane musically. So it was amazing that it, you know, panned out. And then Tom could kind of get into his insane rhythmic stuff without any fear that everyone would be lost. And so he and Craig could just hang on this other level rhythmically, you know, once we played the tunes, and they could sort of take these crazy rhythmic ideas and even extend them further, you know, and it was perfect, you know. And so that went on for a while, and then the Science Friction, you know, every time I start a band, at some point I go, man, I bet this would be amazing with Ducray. Because, you know, I've been playing with Mark since 1988, and almost anything I do, it's like, oh, man, if I had Ducray, it would be amazing, you know. So I started telling Mark about this thing. And so anyway, to make a long story short, I got Mark to come to New York to do this Science Friction thing. And I don't even know, I think we did one gig in New York. You know, I sent Mark a pile of music, and he always learns it and comes in and just nails it. And so, you know, Craig didn't know Mark. I think he'd heard of him for sure. And I'm not sure Tom had played with Mark, or maybe he had. Maybe was Big Satan before that?
I'm not sure. I think it was Hard Sell, then Big Satan, and then Science Friction, which kind of combined the two. I think.
Okay, well, but yeah, and now that you're saying that, I think Big Satan was actually first. But anyway, the idea of Craig and Mark together just was like my brain exploded. And we did it. And, you know, then by then I started working with David Torn in a producing capacity. And this was the first one he produced. He had mastered a lot of them, but this time he was in the studio with us and contributed to the whole sound setup. And, you know, we all played in the room, no headphones. And anyway, it was pretty, for me, it was kind of a landmark thing. Like, oh shit, this has changed everything, you know? And so I kind of milked it for quite a while between that and Hard Sell and Big Satan. You know, I was pretty happy. And that went on consistently probably to 2007 or 8. And then eventually, you know, all these bands fall apart when people get, you know, Craig became really in demand, and Tom also. And so it became difficult to rehearse, and it became, I kind of like bands that I like to rehearse, and I like knowing that people are kind of present mentally, like it's, they're not doing 27 different things, you know, and it always gets to that point where it organically just kind of explodes.
Yeah.
But it was a great ride, and luckily we did that live record, you know, with the Science Friction, which to me, you know, some of my favorite stuff of all time, and same with Hard Sell, you know, it was just incredible ride, you know, and musically, and just playing with those guys all the time, you know, and getting to write for the, you know, these guys who could pretty much do anything. And, you know, I don't think I ever said anything about any improv, you know, it was just, okay, let's go, you know. And I learned more about playing probably from those groups in a way, like my playing probably grew a bit, you know, cause rhythmically I was had shit thrown at me that I'd never seen before in my life, you know? And, but yeah, anyway, that's what that was.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about...
Oh, how were they different?
Well, tell me a little bit about your relationship with Torn. Like, what can you say about what he does with your music and how the two of you kind of work together? Because he seems like a creative partner at this point in a lot of ways.
Totally. Yeah, he's like my... Yeah, I mean, whenever I get an idea, I call him up, you know, and we get excited and talk about it, even if it's something with somebody else. And you know, we probably talk every day. I guess after he produced that Science Friction thing, he said, you know, he said to me, you know, I'd really like to mix one of your records, like a pop album, like work on it for a month, 2 months, do like a mix every, for spend 3 days on a mix. And I said, yeah. And then I started calculating the cost in my head. I thought, oh yeah, that'll be about $12 million. But he said, no, you don't have to pay me for the time. I just want to, I feel like it would reveal way more in the music if I could get into more detail with panning and all different kinds of things. And I don't know if you know much about him, but, you know, he had a tumor. He's deaf in one ear. He can only hear mono. He's been like this for 15, 20 years. And he still has one of the most incredible ears. And, you know, he can hear everything. I mean, he's amazing. So I think the first time we did, I unleashed him on this live thing, the live science fiction thing. And he spent probably 6 weeks mixing it on and off. And the way we work together is, which I love, is he mixes it and then he sends it to me. And then I respond. And usually, 90% of the time, 90% of it is good, is there. And then I might have one thing I'll say, very hypothetical. You know, I might say, what do you think about, you know, the saxophone level? Is it too loud? Or I'll just say something. And then I'll say, nah, I'm sure it's cool. And then he'll say, no, I got to check it out. And then he'll change it. And he'll change something else. And then eventually we get to the final thing. But it's never more than one little thing. You know, he generally, he understands the music and he knows what's supposed to be revealed, you know, mm-hmm. what's important. And one of the things he's great at is really bringing out the bottom end of these records, because most of the time there's no bass, but he knows how to get, kind of separate the piano from itself so that there's all this bottom, kind of the illusion of a bass, but there isn't any. Mm. And I don't know, it's just, you know, I love his musicality. And I love having him in the studio. It's like a security blanket. You know, I don't generally listen to takes while we're recording. So I can just, you know, we'll do a take and then I'll just look at him and I'll know whether we have it or not. Or I'll go out and talk to him for like 2 minutes and just say, hey, what, do we have it? And he goes, yep. Or he says, why don't you try this? This might be cool, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the other people in the band really respect him. It's not like, oh God, here's the producer, you know? So it keeps them from getting neurotic about their playing. You know, he kind of distracts them from getting inside their own heads because he's such a nice guy. And he's also great at kind of, you know, if somebody's nervous, somebody's having a rough day, they'll just go out and talk to him. And all of a sudden they're like, they forget what they're even thinking about. And he has tons of experience. You know, he's played with everybody, all kinds of music. And I love the sounds he gets. And I love, you know, we have an engineer we work with all the time, Daniel Goodwin. And it's like making a film, you know, it's a whole, you know, I get really bummed out when it's over. You know, I love being in a studio with him and because it's just 100% creative all the time, you know, and then I, you know, I'm not somebody who thinks I know everything. You know, I don't know everything about sound. I don't know much about it except what I like. And so I can talk to David and just say, I don't know what to call this, but it needs more air. You know, saxophone needs more air around it, or it's blah, 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 or blah, blah, blah. He understands what I mean, you know, and I can speak in code and I'm sure it's like these, you know, heavy filmmakers who have their editors that they work with and their cameramen. You know, it's the same for me. I work with, you know, the art. I work with Steve Byram. I don't fuck with him. You know, I just say, just, you know, sometimes I'll just say, yeah, this one has to be the most insane ever. And he knows what I'm talking about, you know. And you know, then I get, and then I see it. And then maybe I say one thing or maybe I say nothing, you know. And they don't get defensive. They don't. You know, but they're the experts. You know, I'm not the expert. My thing is the music, and their thing is you know, what they do. And I don't want to mix my own records. You know, I don't even want to go near my computer ever, you know? And so when it comes to music stuff, I have, you know, this little team that I'm totally addicted to, you know, and I've managed to get them in on, you know, the Intact stuff and on the ECM stuff, even. I got Torn in there, you know, and we sort of took over. And it's important to me, you know, it's important to have the people you work with, you know, to have a consistency, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's better to have some, you know, a group of people that you, because eventually it becomes a collective identity, kind of, you know?
Yeah, totally, you know.
So.
And, yeah, so, you know, and, I don't, you know, when you make a record, man, you're so fragile. You really need to have a supportive bunch of people. You can't be fucking around with, you know, is the sound any good? Or are we getting, you know, I don't want to be talking about miking. And I just want to go in there, warm up and play, and then do the next tune, you know, and then make sure lunch is ordered at the right time or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
That's it, pretty much.
Your other... From my perspective as a listener, your other big creative relationship at the right now seems to be with Matt Mitchell, because you've got him in Snake Oil, but then you guys are also doing duo stuff, and he's actually recorded an album of your compositions. So, like, what do you like about working with him? What does he bring to the table for you?
Well, there was a period where I wasn't working with Craig, you know, we kind of stopped just by, you know, osmosis. It just stopped because he was too busy. And I was in about a year and a half, I would say, might have even been longer. I really didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't have a band. I was doing a lot of improv groups, which is all right, but it wasn't, it sort of prepared me to get back into composing. And for a while I wasn't writing, because I needed a band. And I met Matt, I'm sure I'm going to get the date wrong, but I think I met Matt in 2007 teaching, or 2008, at this thing called SIM that Ralph Alessi runs. And Ralph had been telling me about him because he was a student at Eastman when Ralph was teaching there. Ralph said, you should really check out this guy, Matt Mitchell. And he would always say, oh, he can read anything. And then whenever someone says that, I always get scared, because it's like, I don't want to get somebody who's just a, you know, robot. And so sometimes that's code for something else, you know. But Ralph was just saying, this guy can do anything. And Matt was living in Philadelphia and barely playing. He's working at a library. And so Ralph hired him for SIM, and it came time to do the faculty concert. And I always write something for the faculty concert. And so I said to Matt, hey, you want to come over and read some stuff? And he was like, yes, you know. And to give you a little backstory, in 1997, I got a letter from him when he was at Eastman asking me for scores. And he was asking me for scores to this Caos Totale stuff, these pieces that were like 50 minutes long. And at the time I never wrote scores. I would just write parts and then piece it together. And so I write everything by hand. So I was like, oh fuck, how am I going to get this together? And it didn't occur to me that I didn't really have to do it. I could just say, nah, I don't have it. So I felt like this is now the most important thing in my life. So I cobbled together these two scores. There's probably about 30 pages of music. And then I called him. I literally, this took place in 24 hours. I called him back, left him a message, and yeah, it's Tim Byrne. I've sort of got something together, so I'm going to send it to you, but they're not really scores, and I explained what it was. And then he wrote me back, or he called me or something, and he said, how much do you want for it? And I was like, I don't know, $10, you know? So he sent me a check, and I sent him about 100,000 pages of music, and then I never heard from him again. And I thought about it. It was one point where I kind of went, man, whatever happened to that guy? That was kind of weird. And then, you know, I forgot about it. And then 10 years later, I meet him, and he reminded me of that, and I actually still have the letter. I still have it. it's an amazing letter, you know, Mr. Byrne, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so, we played, you know, we rehearsed, and right away, I think after an hour, I asked him if he wanted to start a band. You know, I think he looked at me like, what? You know, and he literally wasn't playing with anybody. And so I said, yeah, I'm going to start a band. Do you want to be in it? He said, yeah. You know, but I live in Philadelphia, so that's all right. It doesn't matter, you know. So I got him, and then I did a session with Chess and Mary Halverson that Mary instigated. And then I had the same kind of weird vibe with Chess. I just thought, wow, I like this guy. I have no idea what he's doing. He's weird as shit. But there's something really serious about him. You know, like we were playing a session, and he wanted to rehearse some music. So I took out this Julius thing, and we're fucking rehearsing. I'd never met him. There's no gig. And this guy's like, you know, yeah, let's do it again, you know. And so I thought, wow, I like this guy. So I'll put him in the band. So I asked him. And then Oscar, who I knew a little bit, I found out he played clarinet. So I invited him over, and we played through this Julia stuff that we've recently recorded on the new Snake Oil live thing, and that we actually recorded back in 2009. And we read through it, and I thought, wow, clarinet, I like this. So I asked him if he would be in a band and just play clarinet. And he said, yeah, sure. So that's how I started Snake Oil. And Matt, you know, was definitely the motivating force. And we had a really, I mean, at first I felt kind of like his big brother, you know. It was, I wouldn't say mentor, but I definitely, we hung out a lot. We talked quite a bit. And I always ran my ideas through him about the group and with the music. And even if we disagreed, I would always sort of run shit through him and play stuff for him and send him something I had written, and he'd send it back. And so, you know, we got really close that way, and he became really trusted. And so, you know, we just kept doing things. Like I think I talked him into doing his first band in New York, which I was in, the Septet. And so I learned all his music, and he was, you know, really happy. And and so we just stayed connected, and you know, the duo stuff was like, oh, this will be challenging. Let's do a duo, you know. And I just like playing music with him, and I never know where it's going to go. You know, he's become, you know, incredibly confident. And so it's really two equals, you know, and at least, you know, maybe not musically, but he's probably more advanced than I am. But you know, when we're on stage, he's not deferring to me, even if we're playing my music. And I love that, you know. And so the duo thing's been great, kind of a bonus. So, yeah, I always run, you know, I'll say, hey, I got this crazy idea. What do you think? You know, and so it's nice. And Seth is that way, too, you know, with me, you know, in a different way. And anyway.
Yeah.
Has it been about 5 hours?
At the beginning of Snake, was it at the beginning of Snake Oil that you were still playing baritone as well as alto?
I don't think I ever played baritone.
Not with Snake Oil, but like around that time, like 2010 or so, you were still playing baritone. Have you just stopped for good, or what happened?
I stopped. You know, I couldn't. For some reason, it became increasingly hard to write and play. And I think it's because I got busier. And, you know, 80% of the time, I have to book my own gigs and organize my own recordings. And, you know, it's just a lot of busy work that takes a lot of mental space away. And I think I just didn't have the mental space to practice alto, practice baritone, and then write. And I love the baritone. And then the thing that took it over the edge was the travel thing. You know, after 9/11, all of a sudden you couldn't travel with a baritone case and leave it somewhere because they thought you were going to bomb the place or some bullshit, you know. And so, you know, I had to deal with carrying my flight case on the train with my alto, with my suitcase, you know, and it got, you know, to go over and play two tunes on a set, you know. And so it just got to be, I kept finding excuses not to bring it, it probably would have been cool in snake oil, but you know, Matt kept asking me and I just couldn't do it. And I think one of the last gigs I did besides forming X Big Band was this big project Matt did where I played Jeff's baritone. And it was really fun. I mean, I loved the baritone, but I just couldn't, you know, I finally sold it because I couldn't stand having it around and not playing it. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like I had to commit to it, something, you know. And so now I find myself, for some reason, the alto, instead of feeling more secure, I feel less secure. So I feel like I'm practicing way more than I used to because I'm constantly being, you know, striving for something I can't figure out.
Huh.
And so I've gotten way into practicing a lot more than in the past, I would say the past 2 years, you know, just trying to, I think doing the Broken Shadows thing, I got more into playing and then kind of looking at my playing and going, okay, what's wrong with it, you know, and trying to get better. So I've gotten more obsessed with practicing and I think the alto's plenty, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw you play with Broken Shadows. I went to one of the gigs at the Jazz Standard in maybe 2019. Mm-hmm. And
yep.
I'm curious about that, because am I right in assuming that the idea for that project kind of came out of the tour that the Bad Plus did, playing Ornette's music from Science Fiction and the album Broken Shadows?
Nah, definitely not. I mean, it really didn't. It came out of me and Chris sitting around one day, and we hadn't played together in a long time except in Forman X Big Band, which wasn't really, you know, we weren't really playing together. We were just kind of on stage together.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, I said, man, we got, let's do a gig, man. Let's just do a fucking gig at Corzo. We never play together. And then we started talking about, we didn't want to do a band, you know, play original music and get obsessed with rehearsing and writing. We just wanted to have fun playing. And so Chris said, why don't we do it with Reed and Dave? And I know Dave, you know, I'd gotten to know Dave pretty well. And I knew Reed pretty well, but I hadn't played with him much. You know, the Science Fiction thing was, we weren't really playing together. I mean, we were, again, you know, it was pretty arranged. There was almost no improvisation for me. And I love those guys, but we weren't really doing anything together. We were just kind of playing the heads and then standing around. It was a cool project, but it wasn't like, you know, playing. And mm-hmm. and so I said, yeah, great, let's do it. And then we talked about it with, I think, with those guys. And then, you know, the Bad Plus never have music on stage. They never have charts. They memorize everything.
Right.
And so one of them, somebody said, yeah, we can't have music. We have to memorize everything. And I was like, oh, shit. I'll never be able to do that. And so that became the first thing, like, okay, if we do this, there can't be any paper. So this is a Corzo gig, right? Pass the hat. And we put together probably about 15 or 20 tunes, Ornette tunes, Julius tunes. You know, my idea was this sort of Fort Worth connection, so it wouldn't be just an Ornette thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought in these Julius tunes. And we did a Dewey tune, and then we did a, you know, Charlie thing. And so it wasn't really an Ornette Coleman tribute band, you know.
Right.
And then we picked all these Ornette tunes that I had never played, that I didn't play with Zorn, and that was cool. And it was very, we all learned the music independently, you know, different people transcribed the tunes. And then we all learned them on our own. And then we got together to rehearse. It was either the day before or the day of. And we rehearsed for an hour, and we just played through the heads. And everybody had it memorized. You know, I was like, holy shit. And I was freaking out because I was like, man, I know I'm going to space out. You know. So I kind of had this, you know, I think me and Chris had a music stand with music piled on it, but we never looked at it. But it was sort of a security blanket at the time. But I remember going, holy shit, this thing with memorizing is the shit, you know, just play differently, you internalize everything. And the first gig was fucking amazing. It was just like, for me, it was a revelation. Like all of a sudden I said, wow, I just played jazz. I can't believe it. You know, I felt like it was the first time I ever played jazz almost. And, you know, in the big sense of the word, you know, I'm memorize the music. I'm soloing. You know, it's like, holy shit, this is fun. I could get used to this, you know. And so I really did. I loved it. And then we started doing tours. And the other nice thing was, relative to my own projects, and I'm sure for everybody else, for Chris, maybe not for the Bad Plus, it was actually something that if you sent someone an email, they'd respond positively.
That's what I was going to say. This is the kind of thing that a festival will fucking jump at, you know?
Yeah, I don't know about that, but we were definitely getting gigs, and we were doing, we did three or four states tours, you know, and we had one canceled with the COVID shit, but, but you know, it was hard. For some reason, it wasn't as easy to book it in Europe, but we did one tour. But, you know, the gigs were a blast, and, you know, obviously people loved it, but more so for me, it was kind of a, you know, I'm in my mid-60s, and all of a sudden, I'm, like, learning how to play. I felt like a beginner. Like, holy shit, man, this is a blast. And, you know, and it got me practicing differently and just got me excited, you know, about playing the saxophone. And, you know, and then I got into that. You know, it's so hard for me to get band gigs, you know, Snake Oil. But it was a bit of a relief from having to try to get gigs and lose money and all that. But then at the same time, you know, I had all this new music for Snake Oil I wanted to record. And the ECM thing was getting to be difficult because they just don't do that many records. And so I decided to do one on my own with Ducray and do that one, I don't know when we did it, last year, 2 years ago, and get torn and just do it and fuck it. You know, we didn't have any gigs. But we got together and, you know, Mark learned the music in about 5 seconds. And we went in and did it, and it was a blast. You know, I got really excited. And then we were supposed to be doing some tours, and then all that got canceled.
Yeah.
And then the live thing kind of fell in my lap. Somebody sent me these recordings, and they were so good. I just said, fuck it, you know, let's put it out. So I was lucky. But, I mean, I think we've done – maybe 2 Snake Oil gigs in the last 2 years. Huh. And one of them was Big Ears, I think.
Yeah.
So it's frustrating, you know, because that band has not, in my mind, it hasn't died, you know, but it's kind of dying because we can't play. So I'm really glad we, you know, made these records.
That's what I was actually wondering about, because you've put out a lot of music in the last year or so. And is part of that just clearing the shelves because there are no gigs, or are you actually producing more music than you were in the past?
Well, it's both. I mean, for me now, making a record's a gig. You know, like the thing with Not Sheet, we did this gig and I had a recording. And probably if COVID didn't happen, I'm not sure I would have thought about it that way. And then I listened to it and I said, fuck, this is great. And then I sent it to Torn, and he made it sound much better. And then because I'm not on ECM anymore, I can put out records whenever I want. You know, they don't get, doesn't get in the way because, you know, they actually try to market the records. So they don't want me putting out, you know, 5 records a year.
Right.
Understandably.
Yeah.
So I was really liberated. I was kind of back in my old days. And so I did that. And then the Snake Oil record came out, and then COVID hit. And for the first couple of months, I was incredibly motivated to write and play for some reason. My wife was home working, and we got sitting next to each other working at the same table. And I just sit around all day and write melodies and play. It was incredible. I was, you know, I felt guilty, but at the time I didn't realize, you know, we'd lose about 2 years of work. So I thought, oh, this is great. This is like an art colony. So there was nothing else to do. You couldn't even go out, you know. So I sat there and I wrote about 40 of these little melodies. And then one day, I think it was April, I'm always getting these brainstorms. And I thought, I called up Torn and I said, you know, why don't we do solo records at home and we'll put them up on my Bandcamp page. And so David is always recording at home. And he can make, you know, he can record on his iPad and it sounds like he was in a studio. I mean, he just knows how to do it. And so he, you know, he said, yeah, let's do it. And so I think it was in April, I just went up to my guest, we have this old guest room, and I went up there, brought my iPhone, and threw it on the bed, hit record, and then I started recording these little pieces I've been working on. I did about four of them, and I kind of went, gosh, this is fun. And this, you know, I'd always been afraid of playing solo, but I was at home, you know, there were no microphones, so I wasn't really nervous. And I didn't really, I tricked myself into thinking I was just fucking around. And so over the course of 3 days, I recorded like 12 of these tunes. And I would send them to Torin and go, you think this is cool? Can you make it sound better? And he would come back and say, yeah, I can make it sound good. Why don't you try putting the phone over here, you know, a little closer to the horn, or over, you know, blah, 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 or face this other wall. Because he kind of knew my house. And so each day I would slightly change with my position. And then I sent it to him and he made it sound great. And then his sounded fucking amazing. And then we put him out and we sold the shit out of him. I mean, it was unbelievable, you know, and that's what's, then I just was obsessed. I was like, okay, I'm going to just put out records like there's no tomorrow. And I kept getting, you know, just when this was happening, this guy, Joe Brancelfort, who's an engineer and a musician, back in 2009, I had hired him to record a bunch of gigs, which was the first Son of Goldfinger gig, the first two Snake Oil gigs, a duo gig with Matt, the septet thing with Shane Ensley, Dan Weiss, Formanek, and Chris Speed, and Ducray, and Formanek and Matt. Mm-hmm. And so he just out of nowhere, he wrote me and said, you know, I'm starting to wipe some hard drives, but I have all these recordings we did. Do you want them? And I sort of was like, huh? And then I said, well, I don't know. Are they any good? And he said, yeah, they're fucking great. So I thought, oh man. So I said, yeah, send them on. And he started telling me what he had. And so I went on this listening binge headphone thing. I just listened to all of it. And I realized that the Son of Goldfinger had some amazing shit. You know, it was all this shit. And then Torin would master them, and then I put them out. But it wasn't like I'm desperate, I'm going to put anything out. It was more like, holy shit, these are great. And now I can do whatever I want, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and the digital thing is as much of a drag as it is, if you accept it as a reality, it's quite liberating. You don't have to pay for packaging. You know, it's sort of perfect for these times. And so, you know, I did it. I did a Broken Shadows. You know, we got somebody recorded a set somewhere on iPhone 5. And I was like, holy shit, this is great, you know. And I got some new thing, you know, a hard sell thing I'm going to put out. I just found a Presence thing that sounds great. So, but you know, I'm no longer thinking, no, marketing. Because it's like doing a gig, you know, there's a sense that you're reaching and, you know, you're reaching out to an audience, you know, you're getting feedback. That's what we need, you know, and if I can't play a gig, then I have to do it this way, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting, right? To me, because, and I had this conversation once a long time ago with Joe Morris, because he had a million records at one point, you know, and
yeah.
I'm always curious when I talk to an artist with a really deep catalog, which is, you know, is, they are often thinking about, you know, they make a record, they release it, and then they're on to the next thing. But from a listener's perspective, it's very different, because the prospect of choosing where to start with an artist who's got 50 albums is very daunting,
right,
compared to starting with an artist who's got five, you know? And so it's like, you know, what if you were offering someone a starting point? Like, what would it, you know, you know, you would say, like, try this, and if you don't like it, try that, or something like that, you know what I mean?
Well, that's what, I mean, the only records that make me cringe are the first few, not for the records, but for my playing, where I felt like I was much more developed as a composer or someone with ideas than as a player. So I would say do those laps just as a research project and say, like, wow, this is what he was doing in 1979, you know. So I would start in the I wouldn't start before the 80s, but I think a particularly, for me, a particularly fertile period. I mean, it's hard to say, like 83, when I did that thing with Motion, Ed Schuller and Herb Robertson. I think that's a cool record. But I would probably go to, from my perspective, I mean, if I was the listener, I'd want to hear, like, maybe Miniature or Fractured Fairy Tales or Sanctified Dreams. That was a good period for me. And the Chaos Totale records, I think, are really, you know, have a lot of shit packed in there. From that point on, you know, the Hemp Hill thing, I think, is really strong. I mean, from that point on, I'm not embarrassed. You know, I would say from early 80s on, theoretically, with Frizzell, you know, at that point I sort of stand behind myself, whatever I did, it was accurate, you know. And even the early ones, I mean, they were accurate, unfortunately, but but you know what I'm saying. And yeah. And but then once the mid to late 80s, Folk Street Mall, I feel like I got into whatever my thing is. I started it, you know, like, okay, now I'm into this, doing weird Tim Byrne music, and I've sort of, you know, that's just kind of keep going. And I've always been obsessed with documenting my stuff as it's happening, not 5 years later. And so I'll always find a way to record, and I'll usually do it when we're at the peak. You know, I can kind of tell when, okay, this is the time. And so, yeah, that stuff, I mean, yeah, any of those, I guess. And then after anything after that, of course. I mean, a lot of people like the Blood Comp stuff. I guess Unwound would probably suck some people in that may or may not like the other stuff. But, you know, everybody's got their opinion. It's nice. I mean, I don't hold it against anyone if they don't agree with me on that. Mm-hmm. You know, but I mean, you know, it started to get really interesting probably, you know, theoretically, Pulp Street Mall, that, and then on from there, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. You know, it's hard to talk about your own shit, but I could probably predict what people would respond to, which would be, you know, the Blood Count Unwound, the first Chaos Totale record. What else? I don't know. Those two would probably, if you're initiating someone who doesn't know what the fuck I'm doing, those would probably do the job, you know?
Yeah. It's this, which kind of, you know, you use the phrase that you're making Tim Byrne music, which is absolutely true, because like I said, I can hear your voice passed down through generations after you. But yeah. It reminds me also, it brings me back to Broken Shadows, because what I noticed at the set that I saw is, you can recognize, like, okay, all the Fort Worth stuff has things in common. It's all sort of Texas-y and bluesy and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. You can recognize an Ornette Coleman composition in like two notes.
Yep.
And is that something that you strive for in your own work, that kind of instant recognizability?
Nope. I don't have any self. I don't really care. Like, I'm not, obviously, I don't really give a shit about being original. I don't care. Yeah, it's a weird question. I kind of think it's difficult to not be recognizable if you're honest about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. If it's not calculated, like if you're not saying, oh, I know an audience will like this, that's when you run into problems. Obviously, I don't do that. You know, I was talking to Bramford this morning, and he said, you know, we're talking about, he was talking about people who are like, complain that everybody doesn't like their music. And he says, well, if you want people to like your music, then you got to make some concessions. If you're going to just do whatever the fuck you want to do, then you can't complain. You know, you're not going to be, everybody's not going to like it. You're going to be playing for 100 people. What's wrong with that? You know, and that's where I stand. That's why my allegiance is really to the ACM guys and the bad guys. Because even now, those guys don't do anything. They don't make calculated moves, you know. Their moves are like, okay, how creative can I be now? What can I do different? What can I do to push myself? It's never like, how can I get a bigger audience, you know? And that's where I stand, you know. I'm with those guys. I feel like that, Julius, I mean, every time he did a gig, he'd write new music when I first met him. He'd lose the other music. I mean, it was like, I remember asking him, I said, man, you just lost all that music. And he's like, I'll just make up some more, you know, and that became my mantra to the point where, you know, now I have to clean out my studio. And somebody asked me, start talking about archival shit. And I'm like, archives, are you shitting me? I can't fucking, yeah, I'm never going to organize this shit.
And no, I'm the same way with my writing. Like, I've written so many hundreds of articles that I'll never see again, you know? It's like...
Yeah, and it bothers me once in a while, you know, like that I don't own half the records I made. And somebody will say, you don't have your records? And I'm like, well, I don't really want to look backwards. You know, that scares me. I don't want to be complacent, you know? To me, the nostalgia part of it is complacency. And so... You know, when I have every time I have a tour or a record, it's like, okay, got to come up with a new set, even though we could easily coast. And it scares me. So the idea of posterity and, you know, I won't say I don't give a shit, but I don't really give a shit, you know, like not enough to spend 6 months doing that instead of playing, you know, but I've got to go get it. Put it in bag. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. You know, I probably have 5,000 sheets of paper, you know, that I have to figure out what to do with it. And it's like, you know, the same tune revised 50,000 times, and I don't do it on the computer, so it's all just on paper, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I have all these recordings over there. I don't even know where to start with that. And to me, I would just take it, put it in baggies, and throw it away. But my wife, nobody will let me do that, you know. So it'll be interesting to see. But to answer your question, you know, I just don't, it's hard for me to think about what people think about me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, every once in a while you have to think about it, you know, you see a review and you get annoyed or something, but basically, I have to keep telling myself, a la what we talked about this morning, is that A, no one's made me do it, and I'm doing what I want, which is better than 90% of the people in the world. So even if I'm not popular to a million people, I get plenty of positive feedback, enough to keep me going. And if I wanted to get more, I know what to do. You know, I'm not stupid. If you want to be popular, you know, you got to change your shit up, you know, that's fine. I don't want to, you know, I enjoy doing what I'm doing, and there are enough people that like it, so it's cool, you know.
Okay, that was my conversation with Tim Byrne, and that's the end of episode 60 of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us improve the website and the show. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.